First case on our calendar is 98-238, Caitlin Pesek versus University Neurologists Association. Mr. Corey.
When did you discover the prejudicial remarks by the other side?
When did I discover them, Your Honor?
Yeah.
When I heard them in court.
You didn't object?
I did object at one point, Your Honor, early in the closing argument. I objected to this very well remarks. I focused directly at myself.
Did you make a continuing objection for the record?
I did not, Your Honor.
You did not?
The research that's indicated in the briefs, the research that I did in these particular cases, indicate that several times this court and other courts have reversed judgments and remanded cases for retrial based on comments by the defense attorneys that fall into several categories. One of the categories is the direct disparagement of fellow attorneys and co-counsel for parties. The other categories are disparagement of experts. The other category is the introduction of evidence into closing arguments that was not actually contained in the records. And I believe that in this particular case, all three of those sins were committed by the defense.
Did the court make it clear that the subject of the settlement should not be gone into?
The court made it clear at the beginning of the trial and instructed the jury clearly that there would be no, the jury should not consider the fact that there was a settlement or the amount of the settlement. It was a very clear statement that was agreed to by both parties and introduced into the trial by the judge.
Was defense counsel in the room at that time?
Yes, he was. In fact, many of the comments in the closing argument seemed to indicate a deliberate indifference to the judge's order. Comments such as, the culprit, we have found the culprit in this case. The culprit in this case is out. The parents had settled in this case for enough money to take care of the child.
What did the trial court do when these comments were made?
The trial court did nothing, Your Honor. I have to express, I know that this panel was not in the room, and I was, and I don't think there's anyone else in the room that was, except Mr. Pesek. The fever or the demonstrative way in which the defense lawyer presented his closing argument can't be expressed in writing or in the record, but he began his closing arguments with what I consider to be relatively legal arguments of the facts and the experts, and then he degenerated into what was really a fanatical tirade. He was almost out of control. He was pointing his finger at me behind the jury and accusing me of suborning of perjury, suppressing.
And you objected at that point?
I did not, Your Honor.
You didn't.
I did not, and I'm sorry I didn't, but there was a...
That you had earlier.
I had earlier, and when he began to accuse me of disreputable conduct, I objected, and the judge overruled.
If we reverse this case on one, any one, or all three of your propositions of law, does that at least sub saliento raise a disciplinary case?
I'm not sure your question. You mean, do I believe that Mr. Barcione violated disciplinary rules?
That's my question.
In fact, I believe I argued that.
Okay. Have you reported that?
I have not, Your Honor.
I
believe it's appropriate for me to report until this panel decides.
Well, that's why I asked you the question. If you think a disciplinary rule has been violated, isn't your duty, regardless of what we do, to report it?
I'm not really sure what my duty is in that. I suppose that same duty would fall on the judge and many of the other members in the court.
Well, it probably does now if we find it to be violative of the rules probably falls on us, but it clearly would fall on you under the rules.
Well, I'm unaware of that.
Well, I just wanted to know if that's... You think our finding, if we reverse this, it amounts to our finding a disciplinary violation?
At the time that I was going through the appeal process, it did not occur to me to go running to the Bar Association to squeal on this commercial. My concern was trying to get a fair trial for these people and see if what he had done is actually rises to the level of reversible error.
You say you didn't think about going to the Bar Association to squeal on him. You've said plenty in here, haven't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay. It sounds it's more than squealing.
Well, I don't know how to answer that, Your Honor. I mean,
it is the question. It concerns me because if and obviously this activity took place, it's bad.
I think it's horrible, and I think it's reprehensible for one lawyer to take on. But I cannot conceive of, and one of the problems I have with the closing arguments in this case is I cannot conceive of a situation where a lawyer would have the right to sit there and accuse.
But counsel, it's very, you know, as you say, we have a record, a written record, and maybe it doesn't give us the full flavor of the situation. It reads very badly. Nevertheless, we're sitting here. The trial judge was there. You were there. And if it were so very horrible, worse than your, you know, as you describe it, why were you not piping up?
Your Honor, there's a point that's reached during this kind of tirade.
Was it a tactic?
I have never been through this before with another attorney. Mm-hmm. There is a point that has reached at which the objections tend to cement.
But I mean, you say there was one. I mean, there's a lot of conduct here that you wish us to look at askance, and yet, at best, I guess you're telling us one time you did say you objected one time. There's a disagreement about that, but let's say you did. There's a lot of conduct and no objections from you.
There's no question about that. It's just that during the process of the trial, there becomes a point at which perhaps the first comment was not sufficient to object because there is some liberality in the closing argument. The second one, you feel that maybe that's not the point to object. The third one, you feel like he's now on a roll. If I step in there, I'm giving some credibility to what he's saying on that particular point.
Or perhaps, I mean, I know that there's times where you feel like it's a bit of an advantage to be quiet, that you think that counsel is hurting himself. And
I don't know that I consciously had a policy that I was not objecting. I don't know that that's the case. What I'm saying is that regardless of whether I objected or not, this kind of behavior should be self-controlling. That these lawyers should not be able to run up to the line, to the limit, and push the limit, and if I don't object, they go farther.
But it's a plain error. You want us to look at it on civil case plain error because the judge didn't? I mean, what standard are we to apply here? Since the judge didn't jump in?
I believe it's plain error on the issue. The issue of misbehavior to close the argument would be plain error. The issue of the instruction would clearly be, I don't know whether that's plain error or just a violation of the court's order.
Do you know this? I know you've checked and you know the standard that this court has set forth for plain error in a civil case.
I've read it. Mm-hmm. And the third issue, of course, is the impropriety of the instruction, which was objected appropriately and was given anyway. The school of thought argument, which we do believe fully that that argument was appropriate in this case.
Counsel, with respect to the third argument, the court felt that there was some evidence presented which would justify the instruction. That's a response. You do ask that argument across the field. There is a view that there was apparently more sympathetic to the argument that led off to that. And then said,
I don't like to accuse courts of appeals of being wrong, but the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals has never actually addressed the issue of the school of thought. I can't actually find any case except one, and it wasn't a medical malpractice case where the school of thought was addressed by any court. And I believe that they are incorrect in the fact that the defense lawyers can, at any time, under any premise that they choose, introduce that instruction. I don't believe they were correct, and we've lost over that.
It is an OJI instruction.
Right.
it is an OJI instruction, and my position is it should have evidence to support it.
And what does it say in this background? What would it say?
Well, what would it take? It would take this is what I would have hoped that they would do for that instruction to be proper. I would have hoped that they would put their own witnesses on the stand and say, this is not a choice of mine to do one thing or the other. I was abiding by a separate school of thought. For their own witnesses to proffer that in their own case sheet into evidence and say, this is a separate school of thought, ladies and gentlemen. And so I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm not saying either one is wrong. They're both correct. Or they could get their own expert to get up there and say, yes, there's two schools of thought. Doctors do it two different ways, and they're both correct. They didn't do any of that. All they did was argue with my expert on the stand on cross-examination and say, Dr. Prince,
I mean, if the other side witnessed it, enough job for your case, that's...
Well, I agree with that, but Dr. Prensky flat out told him there wasn't a second school of thought. So I don't see whether the private instruction would be appropriate for the jury. He flat out told him there is no second school of thought. He said, I've heard the term school of thought. If you think there's a second school of thought, it's absolutely dead wrong.
Wouldn't it be difficult? I guess I wondered how second school of thought would apply where there's a misreading of an MRI. There's a misdiagnosis here. It's not a question. Somebody comes in and presents himself and they have a disease or a condition, and Dr. X, the defendant, treats the patient one way and without any misdiagnosis. There's a diagnosis. Another doctor says, well, there's another way to treat this patient, and here are a lot of doctors who do it. I'm going to ask the appellee the same question, obviously, but isn't it difficult to apply a second school of thought where there's been a misdiagnosis? I mean, that seems to me to be a difficult way to apply it.
Exactly my point. It confuses the jury. They're looking, when you give the jury instruction about a school of thought, they're looking to the record for evidence of what you're talking about. I mean, clearly my expert comes in and says, this is the standard of care. You must give the B6 in circumstances where you don't know what's wrong with the child. Their second school of thought allegedly is to not give the B6 when there's no explanation of what's wrong with the child.
Yeah, if the MRI had been read properly the first time, they would have known what was wrong, or at least what was not wrong with the child. Is that correct, or is that not, do we not know that?
We don't really know if they would have done anything
different. Well, but we know that this condition that the MRI said, the reader of the MRI said was there, was not there.
Right, that's correct.
Right. I have another, just a factual question. The appellee makes a statement in his brief that the second MRI revealed the presence of the corpus callosum. Was the second MRI done at Rainbow Babies or at Cleveland Clinic?
No, it was done at Rainbow Babies and Children's by the same outfit. And the second MRI was done at the half site team of the doctors after the baby was deteriorating seriously. The
council was still there. What is it that you had approved of the argument that's about in terms of responsibility of these doctors? Did it all come down to expert opinions on given the incorrect reading diagnosis that they were given by the person who
was transient?
Does it all turn on whether or not it is malpractice to then proceed to rely on that and to a course of treatment, as opposed to still scanning your training for what are the possibilities here when you're seeing a child exhibit these symptoms?
I would like to reserve some time to see the answer.
Sure.
In this particular case, and in other cases with young children, when you have an anomaly on the radiology, and then you have some symptomology such as seizures, fever, and deterioration in the baby's reserved condition, you go through a routine analysis, a metabolic analysis, especially at a tertiary level hospital like University Hospital, to determine if there are any obvious reasons for the seizure. You don't always rely, at least this is what our experts proffered, you don't always rely on the radiology report as the end-all reasons for why the baby is suffering. Because, in fact, the baby was not responding to typical treatment procedures. The baby was responding to nothing. And our expert said, look, in light of the fact that you have an anomalous and not very definite MRI, you still have to proceed to look. And they didn't. They just sat there and watched the baby deteriorate. And he's saying that you cannot sit there under the standard of care and not go.
Well, they were about treatment.
They did a series of.
And I assume their expert said, given this opinion from the folks, the specialist who led the MRI, that proceeding then to the course of treatment that they undertook would be a logical next step.
Well, I believe their expert's argument was not that clear. It simply said they weren't negligent. I believe the explanation by the defendants themselves, who are excellent doctors, was more along the lines of an expert opinion that the jury could listen to. And they explained what they did and didn't do in the course of the trial. That their explanations were fully made available to my expert, and he discounted them and said they were wrong, that they should have tried the V6 anyway. And in fact, in the trial, the doctors agreed that they were thinking about using the V6 as well, because they didn't have any explanation for the deterioration. And that, of course, is critical for the problem. When he was given the V6, he recovered medically, immediately, not within minutes, but medically in an immediate sense.
Thank you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you.
Mr. Walters.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. This is Steve Walters. I represent the athletes in this case. I'm the client, Dr. Horowitz. I was not present at the trial here because of the PIE litigation. But
Justine.
I believe that the key for us to follow here is the reliance upon the trial judge. The trial judge was present. Trial judge did see the demeanor.
Continue reading the standard trial judge, not stop the decision. I mean, what we have here to read is just one.
I do defend it, Your Honor.
You do?
I do defend it. And I believe the suggestion that there was a disciplinary rule violation is absolutely wrong. I'm not here to defend Mr. Barcione, who was trial counsel, but I also, after having tried scores of cases over almost 30 years, I know the cauldron of emotion that takes place in the courtroom. And I know from the record in this case that we had Mr. Corrigan laughing and making fun of Mr. Barcione during the trial. We had Mr. Corrigan suggesting that Dr. Peterson, who had been an expert on behalf of the plaintiff in the case against Dr. Lanzieri, which was settled, was not brought into court live because he would give adverse testimony, but in fact he didn't come in because he had been threatened.
You think the comments that we read in the brief are acceptable commentary in closing argument?
I think they are perhaps over the top in terms of how an attorney should conduct himself in a courtroom.
The courtroom
does. I don't disagree with that, but the question is, do they descend to the kind of grossly abusive and persistent remarks that are discussed in the various appellate decisions on this? I don't think they are. And I think that we lose sight of everything if we fail to recognize that these were not made out of whole cloth. There was a basis for these events.
In my opinion, though, that makes the situation even worse with the judge not controlling the trial. If you say that Mr. Corrigan, and it's indicated in one of Mr. Partione's comments that he's standing over here and laughing, if that was going on, don't you think that the trial judge had a responsibility to stop this type of behavior on the part of both attorneys?
I think that we need to rely upon the application of discretion by the trial court.
And
he was there. He saw it happen. He saw how abusive it was on either side, if it was abusive.
And he let it go on.
He apparently determined that it had not reached the level where he needed to sua sponte intervene.
Counsel.
I think it's a very dangerous thing if we take away the right of a trial judge to control his own courtroom by suggesting that without any urging by either side.
It appears that this judge was not controlling anything.
I respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor. I don't believe that the characterization, the scenario painted by counsel for the appellant, is accurate.
Counsel.
There were remarks that were made that were not tempered and couched in the kind of language that I would use or that I would hope others would use. But that doesn't sink to the level of prejudicial error.
It seems like there's some relative to some thing that the trial judge can do. Granted, trial judges are all different and unique and deserve wide latitude. But
if I ask the questions, you're really making me mad.
Seems beyond fair. And all the judge has to do is stop things and bring counsel up, have a sidebar, and lay down the law, or law for the office. It doesn't have to be done in front of a jury where it would be prejudicial to somebody who's in the middle of argument. It just stop it.
That's quite correct, Your Honor. He could have done so if he had felt, number one, that it was prejudicing the plaintiff's case, or that the plaintiff's attorney even minded.
What about not prejudicing anyone's case? What about just letting the jury know that this is a civil action, that the lawyers are going to act civilly in the courtroom, and that the judge is in control of the courtroom, and that certain conduct is not going to be permitted because that's not the way we try cases? What would be wrong with that? Should we say that in our opinion, perhaps? Here we adopt creeds of professionalism, all these wonderful statements about how lawyers are going to be civil to each other. And we have before is one of the worst examples of where they are not. And a trial judge sits there, apparently, and doesn't matter to him or her. Is that the message we want to give?
Well, Your Honor.
Our statements, our creeds, and so forth don't mean a thing if we don't enforce them.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, are we to risk the danger of going over the line of suggesting that cases must be tried in a sterile, unemotional argument? Zealous advocacy is an acceptable approach. In fact, I think ethically it's required.
Well, attacking other counsel, laughing at them on one hand and making derogatory remarks about counsel, what does the jury think about that? Is this a case in which there's really a search for the truth, or is it a case in which two lawyers just simply want to bash each other? What's wrong with the trial judge saying, look, I'm not going to stand for this? That doesn't jeopardize anyone's case.
If he
says that we're going to try this case on the facts.
Your Honor, if he felt that it did go that far, then I'm sure he would have intervened.
Well, we may disagree with him. So, Justice Sweeney has a question.
I can't believe that you would, and you have done it in your argument here this morning, condone as good trial practice the blatant disregard of the court's instruction not to go into the settlement or argue the settlement at all. Do you think that's good trial practice to ignore the trial judge who told you that and just go into it anyhow? Is that what you do?
No, Your Honor, but respectfully, I don't believe that the violation of a court order is quite as clear as has been put today. There is no mention of the amount of the settlement. The court, the agreement of counsel for the plaintiff, told the jury at the very outset.
You're splitting hairs. You're trying to justify what I think is unbelievable that you condone it. The blatant disregard of the court's instruction on a settlement. You, as a defense attorney, know how important the settlement of another party is to get to the jury. You probably try and do it all the time if you condone this, because that gives a doubt to the jury in this case. Now, you're condoning something that is very important to a party in the case, and you know it. Is that what you do in the trial of a case?
Judge, this is very important that we all understand this. The court told the jury at the time of voir dire that there had been a settlement, and the court did so without any objection by counsel for the plaintiff. The court said that.
All right. You don't think that the defense counsel went over that in his argument, the amount the lying and all these things that he said, you don't think he went outside of the instruction of the court?
Defense counsel never mentioned an amount. And as far as pointing at Dr. Lanzieri as the culprit, and I believe that word was used,
I read some...
every medical witness who testified said Lanzieri had been negligent and that had thrown everybody off the track from the correct diagnosis. That wasn't even an issue.
I read something about what do they want now? $18 million from this, from my client? Did I read something wrong? That is not mentioned, and an amount is not mentioned?
That's the amount asked for by the plaintiff. And it was misstated, I think. I think it was actually 16, not 18. But that had nothing to do with the settlement. That's not a breach of any instruction of the court, Your Honor. Judge Finn told this jury there was a settlement. Every witness who testified that Dr. Lanzieri was negligent and that it had caused injury to this child. Defense counsel brought up nothing new. He may have expanded on this in terms of emotion, but this was never a violation of any order of the court.
The closest it got, and it is close, where he says they settled for amount that'll satisfy the family's needs or some such thing like that. I know it wasn't this $16 million, but the council did say they settled for an amount that they thought would help, that would be enough to help their family.
There was testimony by the father, James Tessa, in terms of having settled and having taken care of, wanting to be sure that the child was taken care of. This testimony was elicited. There was no objection. No objection whatsoever by plaintiff's counsel. That's not argument. That was in the evidence. You can look at each issue raised by defense counsel and you will find evidence that supports it. Again, this is not out of whole cloth. This is not like some of the cases that you have reviewed in the past where there is language that is vulgar and in that sense brings disrespect upon the court. This is not the kind of case, for example, that was cited in the court below, Jackson versus Booth Memorial, where the expert is called names, because in Jackson, there was an objection. It was overruled by the trial court, but there was an objection. Here, there was no objection. It will send a chilling effect on trial judges across this state if you tell them that they must somehow guess what's offensive to the jury, what's offensive to the plaintiffs.
Oh, counsel, give us a little more credit. I think we could write an opinion that lifted out some of the commentary here. And almost every trial lawyer in the state would recognize that conduct as the kind of conduct they've never engaged in, that they probably more than once have wanted to. And maybe more than once could have said it would have been well justifiable to do that. But most trial lawyers,
Your Honor,
and most judges, most know how to take control of that, and that's why you don't see it in the records. Judges run their courtrooms.
I think, and I've been in front of Judge Fee. This is a no-nonsense judge. I'm sure what may have been going through his mind.
Is this a regular judge or a assigned judge?
Judge Finn is a retired judge,
okay.
But what that means is that he tries more civil cases than the elected judges. So I don't see that as a pejorative category.
That's what we need to
judge
hear.
Finn told this jury, disregard what the attorneys for both sides say on closing argument. It's not evidence. Don't use it as evidence. That was a correct instruction.
Well, that's really curious.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a correct instruction, and I don't have a problem with it. I'm sorry.
An instruction like that is standard.
Yes, it is.
Is your argument that cures all sins?
No, Your Honor. My argument is if this was that offensive to the plaintiff, plaintiff's counsel should have objected. I've been in situations where the attorney gets a little abusive,
well,
and I have often not objected because I felt he was hanging himself in front of the jury, that he was so alienating the jury that they were going to punish him for that kind of behavior.
I'd like to move away from this, and I suspect you would too. I'd like to go to the law, if we could do that.
Sure, Your Honor.
The second school of thought. As I peruse this record, I don't find any evidence upon which to base a charge in the second school of thought.
I disagree, Your Honor.
All right, where can you point me to some?
Yes, Your Honor. Other than
on the cross-examination, I understand that.
There were eight physicians who testified in this case that they do not believe in the prophylactic administration of vitamin B6. By prophylactic, I mean that where you don't have any evidence that there is a dependency or deficiency, you nevertheless go ahead and administer. Eight physicians, and that included Dr. Peterson, who had, in the case against Lanzieri, been an expert of the plaintiff. Now, I don't know if those are the only eight in the world, but I strongly suspect they're not the only eight in the world. It is an approach.
But that isn't the second school of thought, as I understand the second school of thought. That's not even an alternative. They just said, some of them just said, no, we wouldn't treat it that way.
Your Honor,
I thought the second school of thought is we would treat this problem in different ways, not we wouldn't treat it or we would treat it.
The school of thought that we're talking about is the issue of whether or not you prophylactically administer vitamin B6 when you have no basis for it.
Well, no, wait. Let me stop there, because that bothered me. One of the people on the staff, he was an intern, I think, but he was a doctor, immediately spotted the problem and told the consulting doctors here that they should try the B6 treatment, didn't he?
I think that was in one of the later admissions, Your Honor, and this gets a little confusing because I think we had three admissions. It was on that final one in March when the second MRI came through and demonstrated that Dr. Lanzieri had misread the first one, that in fact there was an agenous glossum. The testimony that I'm referring to is testimony by each of these physicians that they do not automatically administer B6 prophylactically. And, Your Honor, it's even stronger here. Here, it's not simply that there was no explanation for this child seizing. Here, there was an explanation. It was a structural anomaly, a congenital deformity of the brain. That was the explanation. Was it right? No, it wasn't right. But it was the explanation put forward by the person couched with the responsibility of reading that MRI. That's the school of thought. And Dr. Prensky, the chief expert for the plaintiffs, admitted that there is a minority who would not administer B6. I don't think there is an issue here. The school of thought instruction has been given for many years in this state. It was given in this case directly from the OJI.
Counsel.
It has been approved at the appellate level. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Walters, how does school of thought differ from the typical malpractice case when tried? Experts give opposing opinions about standard of care. Met the standard of care, didn't meet the standard of care. How is school of thought different than that?
That's a good question. And the way it's different is this. School of thought refers to when a physician consciously makes a decision to take a certain course using the correct information. That's the way he would go. Physician B, however, with the same information, consciously chooses a different way to go.
But to me, that's the same as standard of care. Doctors differ on what is the standard of care. It's to me, not all that. I'm not seeing a real distinction between those two.
No, the issue here was, even in the face of the misleading misdiagnosis
right.
by a non-party,
right.
should they still have given prophylactic vitamin B6? That was really the only issue in this case, in a medical sense. I thank you. I do not believe that there is any justification for saying that the trial judge improperly exercised his discretion, or for saying that the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals somehow missed the boat. This should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Walters. Mr. Corrigan, you use your time. You may take 30 seconds.
I'm sorry, Ron.
You may take 30 seconds.
Well, I have a question. I get very troubled by the fact that you did not object. What troubles me is that we would reverse this case on the basis of the judge responding to the control. Do you not then allow attorneys to sit back and see if the other side would reach a conduct with Angham and you win the case and the jury gets kicked off? Or if you lose, then you can say, oh, I object, the judge should stop this conduct, and now you have a chance to appeal. Do we not give a wrong message to attorneys who should be objecting, who should not play the game, appeal to the jury judge, and take their chances with the court of appeal draft? That's a little dilemma, I think, in the fact that you should not stand up and object. I mean, the defeatist is what you object. Well, if you have objected two or three, and then decide to shut up, you're going to put a clean objection on the record. That tells me that sends a message. How do we deal with that message to them?
I'm not so sure that the issue here is giving carte blanche license to the attorneys to sit back and wait for the judge to do their job, or to give strict guidelines to the judge to step in at his own discretion to interrupt what is really the historic purview of lawyers at closing argument to argue their case. This is not about that. This is about stepping way, way over the line.
And don't you have an obligation on behalf of your client to say, Your Honor, you're stepping over the line, I object, and reserve that to appeal?
Boy, I wish I had, but I did object once. I have to say that these are very complex cases, these medical malpractice cases. There are very few lawyers that do them, and even fewer that do them well. I don't get to this position very often, where I have to sit there and listen to a lawyer berate me personally and point his finger at me and accuse me of laughing. And by the way, I was not laughing. That evidence comes straight from Mr. Barshon, and there is no other evidence of it. I just want the panel to know that. But I don't know.
You're using your time. You need to sum up.
I'm sorry.
You use your time. You need to sum up quickly.
In my point of view, I believe that this court has already set out guidelines, and so have other courts. You can't accuse other lawyers of things. You can't bring evidence into the record that isn't in front of the jury. You can't demean experts as being whores and being paid for and buying their way into neurology.
All right, we've read all that, Counselor. I want to ask just one thing before you sit down. You say on page 4 of your brief, and told the jury reasons for the settlement and the amount. They say nobody said the amount. I can't find it. Did that lawyer say to the jury that Dr. Lazzari, whatever his name was, settled for so much money?
Well, no, he couldn't because he didn't know the amount. It was sealed.
Well,
then
why do you...
I'll point to where he did mention to the jury. He said to the jury, this family would not have settled.
Yeah, I understand. I read all that. I'm asking you to defend the statement in your brief where you say, for the settlement, he told the jury the reasons for the settlement and the amount.
Well, that's not what I was referring to.
Okay, so he didn't say the exact amount.
Oh, he did say $4 million or close to it.
Well, it's on page 4 of your brief.
He said specifically that there would be enough money to take care of them for the rest of their lives. And we were evidence through experts that it would cost close to $12 million to take care of her for the rest of her life. So you draw the line, maybe. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.